Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Welcome to another bonus edition of the Iditapod. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Happy Monday, y'all. That's right, it's Monday as I'm recording this. We had the official start of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race yesterday. In the meantime, the stock market is doing some weird stuff. People are still freaking out about coronavirus and... did I mention it's Monday? Well, it's time to forget about all that because we have an extended interview with friend of the pod, Quince Mountain, who's out there on the Iditarod Trail as we speak. Quince came in for a rather lengthy interview last week. We talked about his past and present, including Quince's experiences being transgender, which if you didn't know, now you know. And as far as we know, he's the first openly trans person in the Iditarod. We talked about that, how in an event that sees all genders competing against each other and not separated into categories, it doesn't mean that much to the race itself, but that, as Quince says, it means a lot to some people in terms of inspiration. We also talked about the origin of the Ugly Dogs. That is a Twitter hashtag and kind of a group of fans who follow Quince and his wife, Blair Braverman. She finished the Iditarod last year. We talked a little about Quince's expectations for his race this year and about how Quince was on the reality TV show Naked and Afraid this last season. Speaking of his experience on that show, just a quick warning, there's a reference to the idea or concerns anyway about the possibility of sexual assault. It's pretty far into the interview that it comes up, but I figured I'd mention it now. There's also a bleeped out curse word in there somewhere before that. Anyway, here's Iditarod rookie Quince Mountain of Mountain, Wisconsin, in an interview here at the Alaska Public Media Studios in Anchorage. We talked first about how Quince got into dog mushing.
I think there's this weird thing when you grow up transgender and you grow up with a sense of yourself. Like I had a sense of myself as male, a sense of myself as a boy. Meanwhile, everybody was telling me that that's wrong, that I'm a girl. And you learn, you're punished for being who you are, and you learn to lie in order to reflect other people's expectations of you, and that can make you a good actor. It can make you a sort of versatile person. I mean, I learned to become what people expected of me or asked of me, and it's gotten me into some wonderful adventures in this life. I tend to say yes, I tend to try things. And when I first started dating my wife Blair, first we went horseback riding for 6 months. She came with me. I was always into horses. And then after a while, it was time to enjoy her hobby with her, which was dog mushing. And once I set foot on the runners, I just kind of never looked back.
Maybe I should back up. How did Blair get into dog mushing?
I think her mother, Jana Kay, filled Blair's life with a lot of propaganda around mushing, a lot of mushing books and Jack London and Iditarod stuff. And so she grew up with a sense of it. And you know, then they moved to Norway when Blair was 10 or something. And so she, you know, she was back there in high school as an exchange student and then lived in Norway some after that. So did a lot of mushing there, went to folk school in Norway.
And I guess tell folks like where you live and how do you support yourself?
I say we live in northern Wisconsin. Blair and I live in the Northwoods of Wisconsin. I used to split my time between Brooklyn and northern Wisconsin, you know, being a writer, and I would have my country home, but would go back to the city to keep up on events and people and just be around, be there, show up. You know, you're not kind of in the mix if you don't show up. But at some point we got sled dogs, and now I split my time mostly between Alaska and Wisconsin. And I think the last 4 years I've been in Alaska more than not.
You guys ever going to move up here? I think I asked you that before, but it's like,
I don't know yet. It's hard to imagine. I've thought about it. It's expensive, so that's a consideration. But right now we're lucky enough to have a lot of support for our team and be able to do this. I mean, you know, we're able to take care of our dogs, but without support, mainly from a very dedicated group of fans called Ugly Dogs who support us, you know, they kind of came to us through Twitter and said, what could we do? And they just seem to... You know, I just look at the horizon. I mean, they seem to keep wanting us to do more of this wild stuff and share our stories. And so it's a deep privilege. And they support us on Patreon, which is a site where people can subscribe kind of to our feed. And, you know, for they can kick in $1 a month or $10 a month. We'll send them trail mail. There are different rewards. And so that helps us fund these big adventures that we get to do.
One thing I feel like we didn't even explain very well last year when you were helping us out with some reporting along the trail was like what the Ugly Dogs are and how that started. I mean, what was the genesis of that?
Well, look, stories happen to the people who can tell them. And my wife is an incredible storyteller. And I'm an essayist too. I'm a writer, but we're very different. I can have a lot happen in a day. You know, I could probably, you know, nearly get hit by a train and be in a car wreck and go to the movies and meet the Queen of England. And then I'll come home and you'll say, how was your day? And I'll be like, oh, great. You know, unremarkable. I mean, I just forget. So I have big stuff happen and I forget to make it into a story. I just sort of absorb it. And then I might think about it later. It's like a thought. I live in my mind analytically. But Blair has a rich life full of memories and imagination and very sensory. And so Blair has found a way to bring that to readers online and to the page, and people love it. So, you know, she kind of developed a group of fans. We both did. And separately, Blair said something that was taken as dismissive of Taylor Swift. It was not intended to be dismissive of Taylor Swift. I don't remember what it was. But she accidentally said something like slightly less than perfect about Taylor Swift online. And if you ever do that, you will be soon the target of Swifties, you know, these sort of Taylor Swift stans. So, you know, and this was before Blair had a big following. You know, there were, I mean, she had, you know, maybe a few thousand people or something followed her on Twitter. But, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these Swifties are writing to Blair just these cruel comments. And one of them said, go back to your ugly dogs, Karen. Because they saw her pictures of dogs. And then, of course, Blair, because she's got a great sense of humor and can be self-aware and step outside herself and she loves to look at things and she's counterphobic and will move toward things that are uncomfortable, she said, oh, I love that sentence. Go back to your ugly dogs, Karen. What a sentence. You know, and at the time, maybe she wasn't aware. There weren't a lot of people calling each other Karens and Chads and all these other first names that we've somehow decided mean something about people, yeah. Which are sad. I'm sorry. I have a friend named Chad, and I'm always a little sorry for him. But he's not a Chad, but he is. He's the best Chad. So she then just like retweeted that and talked about that, and she ended up doing an interview, I think for Rolling Stone or something, of this person who said that and getting to know all these Taylor Swift stans. And then, or maybe she just did it for fun. I don't know. But then the fans of the team started calling themselves the ugly. They said, well, we must be the ugly dogs. This is the dogs aren't ugly. So we must be the ugly dogs. And Blair's coming back to us. Great. So they're the ugly dogs. But that's how it all came about.
You know, this even came up at the Iditarod media briefing, and they said something along the lines of like, we've got to refresh our brand. Just look what Blair Braverman and Quince Mountain have done. And and so I wonder, you know, I mean, it seems like as far as like Musher Twitter goes, you guys are, you know, at least among the most successful, if not the most successful Mushers as far as attracting a Twitter following. What do you think that's all about? I mean, why do people want to follow you guys in particular?
It's not because we have the fastest, winningest dog team in the world. You know what I mean? I mean, that then they can follow my friend Chad and Aaron and Martha at Auto Run Kennel. They have an incredibly successful. In fact, I'm always happy when they do because I'm like, oh, you'll be able to track somebody who will win a race, you know? And I just had a recent third place finish, and that was wonderful. in the Goose Bay 150, but, you know, mostly I've been further toward the back of the pack, and so has Blair, because every time we sort of get good enough at one level, we move up to the next level, and then, you know, there's an adjustment period. But I think over time, our team will get more competitive, and you know, as we learn more and kind of keep leveling, or you know, we're done leveling up at some point, and then just work with what we have. But I think people are mainly following us just for the stories, and then of course, you know, the way algorithms work, whatever. When you start having when you're popular, you're going to get more popular or something. Yeah. I don't know what it is. But I also think, in all seriousness, it's just such an incredible group of people. And it goes far beyond Blair or me. It's become an online and offline community. And it's and you know, people are helping each other out. They're getting to know one another. I know that when the chips are down and I feel bad about something, I always think I can come back. I know I can hop online and talk to Ugly Dogs and have either some sympathy or understanding, or people who call me out on my bullshit. But I mean, truly, I've made friends through this, and I so you have to put a lot into it, and you get a lot out of it. And I guess, you know, there's some mushers who might look at us and think, oh, well, you just hop online and then suddenly you have a lot of fans and you can get sponsorship for your team and this and that. But it's really not. I mean, you really have to, you know, ask not what your people can do for you, I guess, but just share your stories, because people love dogs. People love Alaska. People love the wilderness. People love endurance racing. People love, you know, I mean, we have a lot of followers, I mean, just from all different walks of life. You know, I'm transgender, so we have a lot of LGBTQ followers. We have a blind dog named Harry who led Blair at a very important part in a race and is an important part of our team. And you know, so then we started getting some blind followers, but then they said, well, you know, you could make it, you could add more visual descriptions for your pictures, and it's hard to take part in this. And so Blair started changing, you know, adding those visual descriptions. And so that made it easier for people to participate. And so, you know, we try to be responsive and be accessible, and it gives us back so much. I mean, it's just a culture of abundance, not scarcity, you know. And I look at other teams like, you know, I did a Robert Reddington, or Otter Run Kennel, or Ateo Kennel up in Two Rivers, or, you know, some of the people in Norway or upstate New York. I mean, or Alice White in Ely, Minnesota. I mean, they're doing such cool stuff online and on Twitter too. It's not just us, but all those kennels who give a lot, put a lot into it. People notice.
Yeah, it's like this combination of good storytelling, dogs, like you said, everybody loves dogs, and this wider audience there when you kind of bring people in, right?
Well, and you know, originally that's what really put the race on the radar nationally and internationally. It was when women started winning, you know, when Libby Riddles first won the Iditarod, and then when Susan Butcher won four times, you know, there was a saying, you can still get a t-shirt still that says Alaska, where men are men and women win the Iditarod. Yeah. Because it's one of very few sports where at an elite level, men and women are competing, head to head. And I think it's complicated. Is there misogyny in it? There's misogyny everywhere. So of course there's misogyny in it, but there's also, I think there has to be on some level, a fundamental respect that a lot of the male mushers have for women, because they're being beat by them sometimes, or they're seeing them out on the trail and seeing how tough all the mushers out there are. So, it's really neat to be a part of, and it's neat for me as a trans person, because I don't have to worry about, you know, what category I might be placed in order to take part in the sport. It's just not a thing. I don't even think until recently I was on Discovery show Naked and Afraid. I think before that, I don't think a lot of people even necessarily knew I was trans in the mushing community. Maybe they did. It's always something I've been open about. I'm a writer. I've always been sort of publicly trans. Sometimes I wish I weren't, but I always have been. And so, you know, it's just nice. I don't have to deal with all the questions about which category I belong in, and that's really nice. And also beyond which category would I enter, there's also like the dogs. Like the dogs are my teammates and they don't care. They just don't care. You know, it's not like we're in a locker room and there's some weird dynamic. I mean, we're just all mushing down the trail.
Yeah, that is one really cool thing about the Iditarod. Like you say, I mean, it's not like a running race or something and you've got to pick which category. It's like the men and the women and whoever wants to enter can all race against each other. It's just a really unique thing about dog mushing.
Well, and if you look at the dog bloodlines, that relates to, right? Like, just as the gender of the musher doesn't really matter. I mean, this is an event that's focused on the dogs, and the gender of the dogs also doesn't really matter. The bloodlines of the dogs, they're not bred for some look standard. It doesn't matter what color they are unless you're Jim Lanier and you just prefer to run white dogs because it looks cool. It doesn't matter if they're male or female. It doesn't matter what their background is. They're bred for performance. They need to eat well on the trail over the course of a 1,000-mile race. They need to have tough, a good positive mental attitude, be very forward-oriented and driven, have tough feet, have good coats, a nice Arctic coat that can withstand the conditions and can thrive in the conditions they face out on the trail. So that's what the dogs are bred for, not, who's going to be in the Westminster show next week.
Right. So, I mean, having said, like, gender isn't really that important to the race itself, maybe this is a weird question, but do you see yourself in this race as a openly trans person as being historic in any way? Or do you think about that at all?
It's so weird, Casey. Like, I used to not think about it. And then at some point, you know, as people began asking me about it or commenting on it, I mean, I do sort of think about it. So I go back and forth. Sometimes I think, well, it doesn't really mean anything. It's not really relevant to my race. And I don't want to assume that I'm the first trans person, but as you say, you know, the first, maybe the first openly trans person, I think there's something important there in that I'm not that different. I'm not, you know, history right now, where we're at right now, is allowing me to be the first openly trans person. If I had mushed an Iditarod in 1982, I wouldn't be. I would have kept my gender inclinations to myself probably because I wouldn't have been allowed to get there, most likely. So I have to respect that and understand the people who likely came before me. And also, you know, then I get messages about the people coming after me, coming behind me. And it's so exciting. I mean, I was, you know, I really wasn't able to take part in sports as a kid growing up, in team sports. I know some trans people were, but I wasn't. I had a hard time. It wasn't my experience. I wasn't really allowed on the teams. And so I found ways to do my own thing, ride horses, now dogs. But I never competed with horses in any way. Now with the dogs, I get to be out there challenging myself on this course. But I do think it does matter to a lot of people because I get messages from young people and I get messages from parents. And just today I met somebody, I hung out with somebody a little bit who's also a trans man and, you know, also had an evangelical background that wasn't accepting of it when he was a kid. And so, you know, I think being able to just be out doing my thing, you know, using my platform, I guess, if that, when parents say to me, which, I mean, I keep saying this, but it happens a lot. I get a lot of notes that are like my kid came out to me as trans and, you know, I've been accepting of them, but it was hard to imagine their future. And now seeing you helps me imagine that they can live their dreams, you know, and that gives me chill. I mean, that makes me excited about what all those people are doing. And it probably won't be mushing the Iditarod, but that doesn't matter. You know, whatever it is, the fact that we don't have to be limited in the ways that we have been is pretty fantastic.
Another thing that's pretty wild is this show Naked and Afraid, which I had seen in the past. And, you know, I thought this is this thing that these people go out with no clothes on and no shoes, maybe more importantly, to these places. You were on the show, and how did that go?
Oh, man, how cool. I couldn't turn that down. 2018, we're on the way back from the Kobuk 440, and Blair was contacted somehow. Would you two be interested? We're thinking about doing a couples version of the show, and we invite you to apply. Now, this is a show I watch, and I don't have television. But somehow, every time I'm in a hotel room, I'd end up, you know, Naked and Afraid's on, or I'm on a plane, and I'm just, like, engrossed in this, you know, it's so Edenic. These two strangers are meeting for the first time ever, and naked, they have nothing. They make it 21 days, and you don't make money on it, incidentally. There's, like, no prize. Like, maybe I should have picked a show with, like, a $1 million prize or something in my life. I wouldn't have college debt. But
that's the answer to college debt right there.
Right. But I didn't. I picked a show where, you know, at least, I don't know. If people want to tell me that show is fake. I can't speak for all reality TV. I can't speak for other people's Naked and Afraid challenges. But by golly, I was out there for as long as I was out there. And yeah, there's no secret feather bed and hand warmers and, you know, whatever. I mean, I was just out there with the few things that I had. And yes, there's a film crew and they're there from about 10 a.m. to about 4 p.m. And then you're by yourself, and it's not like some big crew, you know. So I loved it. I loved it. And I had the chance to do it. The reason I wanted to do it was because, you know, when I'm not independently wealthy, when am I going to get a chance to do an adventure like that, to see if I can make it with nothing, but also have medical support where I'm taking on that challenge, but there's a literal MD. There are two MDs. They're each on 12-hour shifts, and they're, you know, a mile or so away or wherever they're staged. I never actually saw their tent. But, you know, there is some safety mechanism there if I get bitten by a brown recluse, as Blair did, or a what's that snake? We killed one of them.
A fur de lance snake.
And we killed it, but not on film, which, well, we were outside of the, but it came in the camp. And anyhow.
Where did they send you, actually, though?
Honduras.
Oh, right.
So, yeah, in Pico Bonito National Park, I think, a beautiful mountain rainforest area. And it just rained and rained. There was a lot of rain.
But they were going to send you somewhere else, right? Didn't you do a bunch of research?
Oh, they were going to send me to Mozambique. And so I did some tanning, Casey. I joined a tanning club or got a card or whatever. Went to the tanning place to get ready for Mozambique. I contacted friends in Florida who know things about crocodiles and alligators and how to subdue them with your hands and a piece of rope that you braid, you know. I practiced all these things.
That sounds like fun.
Was gonna, you know, build certain traps, and I was gonna be on this big lake called Kohara Basa. And, you know, they tell you a few weeks beforehand what general region you'll be in, so you could study up on it. And I did, and I started studying the literature of Mozambique and reading Mozambican novels, watching shows, anything that I could get my hands on, because also as a trans person, you know, and this is something I have to say, I want to say a couple things about my experience on that show, and I don't think I've gotten to talk about this elsewhere. Number one, when they asked us to try out for that show. I don't even think they knew I was trans. And when I talked about it a little, the producers said to me, you know, this doesn't have to be something that you talk about or not. So it was never like a contingency for me to be part of the show, as far as I knew. I got to be on it for other reasons, and I chose to talk about it because it was very organic. If I'm meeting somebody for the first time and I'm naked and I have surgery scars and I look different, I'm going to disclose that part of my history. That's something I would do whether I'm on television or not. So it just was naturally what I do. But they did ask me if I wanted to or you know, what I would be doing. And they were very supportive. But one day, you know, the day before I went out or 2 days before I went out, the field producer and I, there were two of them. We were sitting there and they said, well, you know, it doesn't really make a difference that you're trans. And I said, well, yeah, it does. And they said, well, we have a very professional film crew. They're not even thinking about your body. And this, and I, you know, I have no doubt that way. It was absolutely an incredible crew that I had. But I said, well, what happens when I get hurt and I'm medevaced to the hospital and I'm in a place where, you know, in the little bubble of, you know, camera folks and a shooter producer from LA and all these people, it's fine. But now I go to the hospital and I'm relying on, you know, a nurse or a doctor to treat me in a place where they think, you know, the way to fix your gender incongruency is corrective rape or whatever. I mean, it's all fine until it's not. And so that's the privilege, you know, that people can have when they haven't had that experience. And to the credit of the producers who were out in the field with me, I mean, they very much listen. And I don't know what they did, but I really trust that they kind of thought about that, did something with it. But I was, you know, I go through and I read all these books just in case, like, I'm medevac somewhere and now I have to get the ambulance person on my side so that they don't think I'm, and now I will use the C word, crazy. So they don't, you know, dismiss me as somebody not really worthy of the best care. So, you know, pop culture, books, shows, maybe I can learn a few phrases. These small things might get me somebody on my side. So even while I'm preparing to be naked and potentially alone or with a partner I've never met in the jungle, I'm also preparing for, like, what could go wrong? Maybe at a different level from other contestants, I don't know. But, you know, ironically, a few days beforehand, I ended up going to Honduras, not Mozambique.
Switcheroo.
So... But if you want to know about the novels of Mia Kuto, we can talk.
I don't know if we should spoil it for people that maybe haven't seen it.
No, we can't spoil it.
We can't spoil it. You had a good time and a bad time at some times, but you survived. Or did you die?
So far, we've all survived as far as what they've aired.
I want to ask, what do you expect out of this year's race as a rookie, and sort of what are you hoping to accomplish, I guess?
I would love to do as well as I can with our dogs having a happy, healthy team and make it to Nome. I really see, I'm in a beautifully privileged position of not having to think about my competitors or anything else. That's not what I'm racing against. I'm trying to complete the course. And so I think of it as having these dogs and having the right gear and the right attitude and the right training to get us up over the Alaska Range, which itself is an incredible goal, but then through the rarely traveled interior and then, you know, along a river for a couple hundred miles and then up the coast a couple hundred miles and come into Nome by dog team. That's what I'd like to do. Hopefully in time for the banquet.
Quince, tell me about your team. Is it similar to the team that Blair ran last year, or is it a different makeup or what?
Well, Blair had a really great team last year. I have a really great team this year. A lot of the dogs I'm running this year have been in the Iditarod before, have been to Nome. I get to run dogs belonging to a friend of ours, Ramey Reddington. So there's incredible history to that team, and I've learned a lot working with him, and a lot that I'm going to bring back home at some point to some of those younger dogs we have coming up in training, you know, that go back to our leader Pepe, and as well as going back to his dogs. So, you know, the dogs, a lot of the dogs are related to our dogs in Wisconsin, but just want a little bit of an older, more experienced team, and a little bit of an older, more experienced coach.
That was Iditarod rookie Quince Mountain, friend of the pod. Thanks to him for being willing to talk about all of that, and thanks to you for listening to the Iditapod. Stay tuned for another full episode. I'm Casey Grove. Until next time, happy trails.